Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Jocks. It is Wednesday, July 29th. Today we talk fuel prices and bus service as the Iran war puts the squeeze on transportation budgets. We turn our attention to a congressional race where an incumbent is being challenged by a veteran state lawmaker. We hear about the showdown between Case and Kioho Kalole. We look at funding for the Peace Corps as it celebrates its 65th anniversary, where funding stands as it struggles to survive budget cuts. We meet a small bird with a tennis ball green coat on this week's Manu Minute, and we break down the mechanics of swimming with longtime University of Hawaii swim coach Jan Prinz. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The war with Iran has pushed fuel prices upward. The price at the pump is putting a strain on transportation budgets, including that of the bus. Today, HBR's Savannah Herman-Poe joins us to talk about how the counties are coping with the unexpected rise. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what did you learn?
Yeah, so when we're talking about fuel costs for public transportation agencies, we're really talking mainly about diesel. And gas prices are high, but diesel prices are just eye-watering right now. And in the first month of the Iran war, our local transit agencies saw diesel prices spike significantly. So one of the people that I reached out to is Zach Burgum. He heads Hawaii County's Mass Transit Agency. And he said before the Iran war, his agency was paying about $3 and change for a gallon of diesel. And then come March, that cost climbed to above $5, and by April, it was well above $6, so almost double what they've been paying just 2 months ago. And the Kauai Transportation Agency also said that it saw about a 34% rise in fuel costs over the course of the last fiscal year. That ended in June. And the agency actually ended up going over its planned budget for fuel by about $145,000 and ended up dipping into some federal funds it had on hand to cover the difference. And then Honolulu's Department of Transit Services also went over its fuel budget by about $2.5 million. That expenditure made sense when you consider that they are the largest county-level transit services department. But they used city contingency funds and then found savings elsewhere in their operations to cover those additional costs. The department's director, Roger Morton, told me that Honolulu's public bus system may face even higher costs this year since recent escalations of the conflict between the U.S. and Iran have driven diesel prices back above $5. And the department's fuel budget for the next 12 months is about $18 million. Morton thinks it's possible that the department could end up paying anywhere from $20 to $25 million for fuel over the course of the next year.
If the prices were to stay where they're at now, then we would be substantially over our budget by the end of the fiscal year. I think it's inevitable that we'll be over the budget, but the question is whether the price that we pay for fuel will be somewhere between $20 and $25 million for the year. And that'll be dependent upon world events. It's still pretty early in the fiscal year, so I think we all hope that the conflict will be resolved and that fuel will go down in price.
You know, it's a good thing that they had some wiggle room and some money in reserves, you know, both here in Honolulu and the Big Island.
Yeah, so Big Island has a big cushion for its fuel prices. They came in well within budget. When we're looking at how Honolulu might cover additional costs in this coming year, it's not totally clear how they're going to make up that gap. They could potentially tap into more contingency funds. They could get more creative. So one of the places that the department found savings this year was actually in unused salaries and benefits for bus operators. That was some money that had been set aside but didn't end up getting used, and so they could put it towards fuel costs. I do want to note also when we're thinking about these departments, for everyone that I talked to, fuel costs make up about they make up less than 10% of the overall budget for the departments. So even when costs rise, it's still a small fraction of their overall funding picture. But at least in Honolulu, the funding gap for fuel could potentially be much bigger this year. And Morton also notes that public transportation is not the only agency that's getting hit by higher costs. So any department that has an electric bill has likely seen a spike in recent months, as Oahu's energy grid is mostly powered by imported oil. And so he's expecting it to be a tough budget year for the city all around.
Oh, yeah. And not just for the buses, too, right? I'm thinking of like the garbage guys, right? The folks that pick up our Opala. I don't know if those trucks run on diesel as well.
I'm not sure about those trucks, if they run on diesel. But, for instance, paratransit, that largely runs on gasoline. A lot of the city's fleet runs on gasoline as well. But one of the longer-term strategies to addressing fuel costs is more electrification, right? So Honolulu has about 17 electric buses already, and it's working to getting more than 100 electric buses out on the road. The rail, for instance, is electrified. And running an electric bus or an electric rail is not free. You still have to pay for the electricity you're using, but it is cheaper than paying for diesel. And maintenance costs on electric vehicles are also typically lower. The other counties are working on electrification as well. So thanks to federal funds, Kauai, Maui, and Hawaii Island each got 4 new electric buses this year. And I talked to Zach Burgum about this because on Hawaii Island, it's so large, right? So I asked whether range for an electric bus was a problem. And he said that the new electric buses have been able to crisscross the island pretty easily.
Since running them just this past, since the beginning of the year, you know, the buses can run from Hilo, and then they can travel over Saddle, or they can also go up Hamakua Coast through Waimea into Kona. And generally, these buses are, you know, getting to the west side of the island with just above 70% left on the battery capacity, which is pretty phenomenal when you think about it, you know, with a full load of people, battery electric bus running across Saddle and thinking about that incline. But also, you know, these buses do also generate some energy on the descent as well. So they do regen some energy on the descent. But it's pretty remarkable.
You know, and what are they seeing as far as the users? You know, are there more people taking the bus, less people? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So gas is really expensive at the pump. And all the three agencies that I talked to, Hawaii, Oahu, and Kauai, they reported a modest but noticeable uptick in ridership on their buses in the last year. And they attribute that at least in part to people who are opting not to drive so that they don't have to pay these extremely high fuel costs. And that's important, right? Because as they're considering how to save money themselves, one of the things that they say is not on the table this time is hiking fares for people who are riding the bus. That doesn't account for Big Island, where fares are free, or cutting routes as a strategy to deal with rising fuel costs. They're encouraging people to take or consider the bus as an option in this time.
Yes, the bus and rail. But yeah, thank you so much, Savannah. Yeah, it's an interesting snapshot of where we're at.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HPR Savannah Herrmann-Pote. Look for her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Aloha, I'm Chris Vandercook. Join me and my band for Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton on Saturday, August 29th at 6 p.m. for Big City Blues. We'll celebrate the music of B.B. King, Ray Charles, and the post-war blues masters with an evening of soulful, high-energy blues. Get your tickets now at hpr.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, featuring Kau Black Honey with notes of maple butter, tamarind, and wildflower honey at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
This morning, we're joined by HPR's government reporter, Audrey McEvoy. She's been spending time with candidates in advance of the primary election. Today, she looks at the 1st Congressional District. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so you had fun out on the road trailing some of these candidates.
Yes, I did.
And so tell us about this race, because we have incumbent Ed Case being challenged by a state senator.
Yes. So we find often in Hawaii, incumbents don't necessarily get challenged in the primaries. It's really expensive to launch a challenge. The incumbents have an advantage with name recognition and also fundraising, and so often it doesn't really happen. But this time we have a challenger from an experienced legislator and state senator, Jared Keohokolole.
So tell us about him.
So Jared Keohokolole, he represents Kaneohe and Kailua in the state Senate. He's been a legislator for about 12 years. He's not that well known outside his district. He had children film a video advertisement.
Yes, I singing, heard about that campaign ad.
Singing his last name. It was sort of a way for people to learn how to say his name.
Yes, it's a bit of a tongue twister. I have problems with it as well. But yeah, and the senator can run, but he still, if he loses, he still keeps his Senate seat.
Yes, that's correct. And so that may be one advantage that he has. There's not as much of a risk. He doesn't face as much of a risk in mounting this campaign challenge.
Yes, and I know Representative Case, you know, talks about his seniority, you know, in Congress, and that he sees that as the edge that he's got in this campaign.
Exactly. When I talked to Ed Case, he told me that his seniority and his position on the Appropriations Committee helped him secure billions of dollars for the Maui wildfires, for the Red Hill crisis, and for the coronavirus pandemic. And so one thing he said is, well, what happens after the next crisis?
And so what did Keohokolole say about why he's running?
Well, so he said that voters want leaders to oppose President Donald Trump and the Iran war.
By far the top concern is to push back against Trump. There is a lot of frustration with the chaos and uncertainty, the grift that's taking place right now, that's unprecedented in our history. And for me as a millennial who, you know, experienced the Iraq war right after entering adulthood, I think it's very frustrating to find ourselves in the midst of another forever war in the Middle East with no plan and, you know, not a lot of action out of my opponent to take definitive steps to push back on this and stop funding this catastrophe.
And what did Case say about this?
So Case says that he has voted to impeach the president twice and has participated in lawsuits against the administration. He criticized Keohokolole for failing to study his record.
He knows nothing about what he's talking about in terms of what I have or haven't done with the Trump administration. Now take the defense budget and the war. What he fails to realize, if he took the time to even review my record one little bit, as opposed to just slap it up on the wall and see what sticks, is that I have voted a number of times already to oppose this war on the basis that it is not authorized by Congress. I have also voted in my defense subcommittee specifically against funding the Department of Defense because, in part, authority for this war was not gained. I've done a number of those votes already, and I have spoken directly in the defense subcommittee in opposition to the defense budget on a number of grounds, including the Iran war.
And so what does Keohokolole say about other issues in this race?
So Keohokolole says that we need a leader who has the energy to address issues like inflation and the Iran war and threats to democracy. And there's one particular issue that he said that sort of pushed him to declare his candidacy, and that was seeing how Case reacted to immigration raids on Maui. So that was when ICE agents detained teachers on Maui at gunpoint.
Yeah, that was a headline grabber for sure, you know, to see that happen here in Hawaii. But what was Case's reaction to that?
So Kealakulele was troubled that Case didn't join the other three members of Hawaii's congressional delegation in sending a letter to the Department of Homeland Security expressing concern about what happened and trying to clarify what the department's policies were for carrying out immigration raids. And that letter said that DHS was needlessly aggressive, was carrying out needlessly aggressive immigration enforcement, and that this was creating chaos and confusion. And the letter also asked the agency to consider different approaches.
Yeah, and I know, you know, we've had Case on the show, and I know he's talked about the need to, rethink, you know, the whole process with green cards and applying for citizenship. So I know he feels very strongly about his record on some of these immigration issues.
Yeah, and he said that he's spoken out against ICE abuses and ICE tactics, and that he voted against funding for ICE because of these abuses, particularly the killings in Minnesota and other places.
And then Case got some attention last year for one of his votes on voter registration. How's that playing out in the campaign?
Yes. So that was the Safeguard America Voter Eligibility Act, or SAVE Act. It would have required proof of citizenship to register to vote. And Case was one of four Democrats who joined Republicans to pass that bill in the House. And Kealakulele was very critical of that bill.
And why is that?
So the bill would have established cumbersome identification requirements. So to register to vote, you would have had to present a passport or some other ID to prove that you're a U.S. citizen. So Kealakulele says that this amounted to voter suppression and it would disenfranchise voters.
And what did Case have to say about that?
So Case says that the bill had accommodations for people who didn't have IDs, that they could simply attest and declare that under penalty of perjury that they were a U.S. citizen and thus had the right to vote.
And then as far as, you know, what's happening across the country, I don't know, are incumbents seeing, more challenges in this area?
Yeah, so Democratic Socialist and Progressive challengers have defeated incumbents in both New York and in Colorado. There's a bit of an anti-incumbent mood that has helped fuel these upsets.
And so what does Kealakulele consider himself?
So I asked Kealakulele where he fell on the political spectrum, and he said that he was a Democrat.
In cases on the conservative end of the Democratic Party, I know covering him at the legislature, he's often gone rogue on the party, and some people like that independence. But he hasn't always gotten, you know, let's say the union backing in some of his races.
Yeah, and the unions are heavily backing Kealakulele. At the campaign launch event, rally event that I went to for Kealakulele the other week, there were several tables of union groups, filling out postcards to send to voters and preparing flyers to attach to voter doorknobs. I think there are about 20 unions that have endorsed Kealakulele, and Case is known for being more conservative. He was a longtime member of the Blue Dog Coalition of Fiscal Conservatives.
And gosh, so, you know, I don't know how their campaign war chests stack up, you know, but, you know, I just know that, you know, we're hearing that there are polls that have this as a very close race.
Yes, it's really hard to tell what will happen. I don't think that there have been public opinion polls, publicly published polls by independent organizations on, you know, how voters are feeling. So we'll have to see with the election results.
Yeah. And with that, just, you know, days away, we'll see what other, you know, ads might be popping up, in the days leading up to election day. But we appreciate your coverage.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's new addition to the newsroom, Audrey McElvoy. You can find her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omau, okahoolabe, ohavai.
A penny saved is a penny earned. And if you knew the name of the founding father that coined this iconic phrase, this quiz is for you. Ben Franklin Crafts has been the place to go for craft supplies in Hawaii for more than 70 years. But the local chain started small. Its first location was called a Kei Kamitake store. It was operated by the franchise's matriarch, Shikano Kamitake. It sold small dry goods and custom aloha shirts before becoming Kahului Dry Goods years later. But where does Ben Franklin come into play, and why was a craft store named after him? Well, he didn't love to knit, but he did love making money, so much so that Ben Franklin's name was used as a moniker for a national chain of a five-and-dime craft store originating in Boston. The Keiki of the Kamitake Ohana had assumed ownership of its store and acquired the franchise rights for the Ben Franklin name back in 1951. For today's quiz, can you tell us how many Ben Franklin stores are located across the islands? And yes, the House Smart Ben Franklin's Crafts on Maui counts as one. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689. First one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Carolyn McKenzie is a former Peace Corps worker in Ukraine. She's the president of Return Peace Corps Volunteers here in the islands. And McKenzie joined hundreds of others in our nation's capital last week to lobby for continued funding for an organization that this year marks its 65th year. They were in Washington, D.C. for their annual conference, and McKenzie just returned Monday night and talked to us yesterday about where things stand with the federal budget.
We had a wonderful conference, and on Monday, July 20th, we met with all of Hawaii's congressional delegation. And first off, we all have to say thank you because the Hawaii delegation truly, truly appreciates Peace Corps. And they work across the aisle because we've had a few scares where a representative tried from Pennsylvania tried to eliminate Peace Corps. But the push this year, as we learned from the Peace Corps chief of staff, this administration actually wants to have 8,000 volunteers back in the field as it was before COVID. The problem and the reason we are lobbying is that the budget the administration has is only $410 million, which is the budget for when I was in Peace Corps in 2010. So the current number doesn't account for inflation, et cetera. So we are pushing, and we went to all our congressional reps, to push for the Senate budget request of $479 million, which is still a drop in the bucket, but a lot better than $410.
Yes, and we should point out, though, is that there have been efforts to zero out the budget for the Peace Corps, and that fortunately is not the case.
No, that is absolutely correct. Just 2 weeks ago, a representative from Pennsylvania went to the floor and attached to whatever budget, there's so many of them right now, that he wanted to eliminate the Peace Corps as it is. And thankfully, Representative Garamendi in California, who is a Democrat and a returned Peace Corps volunteer, works with his Republican congressional colleague from American Samoa, who remembers Peace Corps volunteers who served in the 60s and 70s, and the value of what Peace Corps is, the two of them stood up And actually, the representative from Pennsylvania had to withdraw his motion because there was no support.
Well, so going forward, we are marking this anniversary this year. And I know there's been, you know, lots of efforts to raise the awareness.
No, the thing that's cool, Catherine, is that, yes, Peace Corps is 65 years young. And one of the reasons we're pushing for more funding is we'd like to be another 65 years so we could be maybe 130 years old. But we also are going back. The big push is to reopen some of the Pacific Island nations where we were. And while we weren't sure how we could talk about it, talking with every one of our congressional representatives from Hawaii, they are pushing to get Peace Corps back. And I just saw last week as I was coming back from the conference that we are now back in the Solomon Islands. And 2 years ago, we returned to Palau. And much of the work in Palau is now the ocean safety, coral research, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's interesting because I hadn't realized that they had pulled back the program from the Pacific.
Oh, there's been a lot of pullbacks. But interestingly enough, again, the administration actually has Peace Corps in, as a line item. And when you look at current Peace Corps, it's not just the 27-month volunteer. You also have the short-term response volunteers, which are countries that can't host a volunteer for 2.5 years, but they have jobs and would like a Peace Corps volunteer for less than a year to set up a support group. I mean, it's a really interesting program because it's a very intense, focused program. You can go on the government website, peacecorps.gov.response, and it's fun to see short-term, high-impact jobs that are less than a year. So that's another cool program that has to stay. Then again, the third and fourth newest initiatives are the virtual Peace Corps, where a lot of it is teaching English from your home to people overseas in various Peace Corps countries. And the newest one that I guess the president just talked about was the Artificial Intelligence Technology Corps, working with people in India. So if they really want to do this, they really need the $479 million at the minimum.
Well, it's fascinating, you know. I mean, these different programs you're talking about, right? The rapid response, Peace Corps volunteers. Certainly, you know, the program has morphed over its 65 years.
That happened in about when I came home and had moved to Hawaii. The Peace Corps director, Carrie Hassler Radlett, I believe that was her name, she was the one that pushed for response because a lot of return volunteers would go back to their country, but not particularly for 2.5 years, as either we're older or we have too many commitments or family at home, but they would like to return and help. So seriously, any listener who is interested in Peace Corps, but not 2.5 years, Peace Corps response is such a wonderful way to serve your country on a shorter term, sometimes 6 months, but definitely a year or less.
No, that's fascinating. And, you know, I know during your time in the Peace Corps, you were in Ukraine. And I'm sure given
right.
the situation there, you know, that I imagine that program has been curtailed.
The program is curtailed, and that's where sort of the virtual English program came into being because so many Ukrainians still would like to learn English. So, I mean, they actually asked me if I was interested, but it's a 12-hour time difference, and the time was going to be 3 in the morning for me and 3 in the afternoon for them. So I sort of politely declined because I don't think I'm at my most brilliant at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, not ideal.
Yeah, bad idea. But on the other hand, a lot of other people, especially in countries now, I think they've also opened it up for healthcare initiatives where people who have healthcare backgrounds can talk to people in countries looking for healthcare help. But yes, to answer your question, Ukraine, I follow it. It's sad. It's very sad. But it's interesting that just, I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago, the Iranians have figured out how to put drones in the Caspian Sea and get back at the Russians who are trying to run fuel elsewhere. So you got to give the Ukrainians initiative and credit. They are still pushing to end this war and keep their boundaries.
Well, you know, the whole world is in turmoil, you know, and you know, certainly with the Peace Corps, you know, as its name, right? It underscores, yeah, you know, what the hope is. Peace everywhere.
Wait, also, yeah, well, we're also, it's interesting because when we were talking with all our representatives, everyone truly admits that Peace Corps is soft diplomacy. And while we aren't diplomats, et cetera, we are boots on the ground ambassadors, and we are invited to come to countries. Still, people like us. And so it's a wonderful sort of entry into a country, working side by side with locals. And it's just the best program, seriously, you know, the best use of our taxpayer dollars, even if it's only 0.00001% of the budget.
Well, we certainly appreciate your service in the Peace Corps, and we thank you for this update on where things are in our nation's capital today.
Oh, no, well, thanks for calling, and thanks for letting me share my experience. And please, all the listeners, as Ed Case's staff told us, because we were asking what we could do to help, what we as Hawaii could do to help push for Peace Corps, his staff assistant said, make noise. So keep contacting our representatives. And if you have friends on the mainland that like Peace Corps, contact your representative. Make noise.
Okay. And then are there any other events that you folks have scheduled for the 65th?
Oh, well, the 65th we will have. It's on right now at the University of Hawaii. The Hamilton Library has a wonderful exhibit by a return volunteer who has a PhD in music, Ben Fairfield. And it's an exhibit. It's on until August 10. And it's about the instruments that he learned to make from recycled equipment. Ben served in Thailand by the Korean border, and his instruments are made of recycled spam cans and bicycle chains. And our group will be there Sunday, August 2nd, because we can park for free at the campus. If anybody wants to meet us at 12 noon and have a guided tour with the Peace Corps, with Ben, who put this exhibit together, they're welcome to meet us. All right?
All right. Thank you so much, Caroline. We've been hearing from Carolyn McKenzie with the Return Peace Corps Volunteers Organization here in the islands.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art Cafe, serving dinner on Fridays, featuring globally influenced American cuisine and live music. Reservations at honolulumuseum.org.
Iran's violent crackdown on mass protests earlier this year killed thousands of people. The mothers of the dead are now organizing to demand justice.
You might threaten someone, scare someone, arrest them, and stop them from doing activity again, but you cannot stop a mother from grieving.
Hear that story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For nearly 90 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to one of Hawaii's many honey creepers, the Amaki.
In Ohia forests all over the Big Island, you can hear the song of the Hawaii Amakihi. It's one of over 50 species known as Hawaiian honey creepers that all trace their ancestry to a single finch that came from Asia to Hawaii over 5 million years ago. Amakihi forage for nectar and insects, and sometimes even fly into neighborhoods in Puna and Kona. In traditional Hawaiian culture, their yellow and green feathers were used in beautiful ahuula, or feather cloaks, worn by the ali'i. In stories, their calls were often seen as the scolding voice of reason. Because mosquitoes are not native to Hawaii, many honey creepers don't have a natural resistance to mosquito-transmitted diseases like avian malaria. But lucky for us, the Amakihi is one of the few that does.
For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail. Learn more about the Mauna Kea Summit and STARS Give Back experience, including a volunteering opportunity, at hawaii-forest.com.
You know, earlier in the show, we asked you how many Ben Franklin craft stores are located in the state, and technically, they're not Ben Franklin craft stores at all anymore. In 2013, the franchise was rebranded with the Housemart name slapped on the front. So now it's Housemart Ben Franklin Crafts, and that's a bit of a mouthful. And there aren't many Ben Franklin crafts around anymore, as the parent company, Ben Franklin Retail Stores Incorporated, went bankrupt in 1996. Now, only a few craft stores around the world sport the founding father's name. Six of them are located in Hawaii, one on the Big Island, one on Maui, and four on Oahu. The chain's continued success has been attributed to Hawaii's unique need for craft supplies year-round. From birthday parties to graduation celebrations, we do love to celebrate any occasion here in Hawaii. And congrats to our winner, who's a little shy and only wanted to be identified as a Hawaiian from Kailua. But my burning question is, are you a crafter? But thank you for playing our game today. That's our quiz. And if you have one you'd like to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Hawaii Public Radio invites you to a special Live from the Atherton Storytellers event, Stories from the Top. The Young Musicians Showcase has brightened our Saturday mornings on HPR2. Now hear stories from some of the musicians' journeys with Joshua Nakazawa and Taiga Benito. This free event is Thursday, August 6th at 6 p.m. with doors opening at 5:30. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
A Global Drowning Prevention Day this past weekend brought attention to the more than 200,000 people who drown each year. In Hawaii, the state has the second highest drowning rate nationally, with nearly 800 drownings over the past decade. Drowning is also the number one cause of child mortality under 15. Jan Prince has swimming under his skin, and he's sharing that passion in a new book. The University of Hawaii swim coach and lecturer has coached teams for the Sri Lanka 1984 Olympics and the 1986 Asian Games, and the U.S. team for the inaugural Invictus Games in London in 2014. Swimming has taken Prinz all over the world, but his love for Hawaii brought him back to the islands as head swim coach for the University of Hawaii back in the 1970s. His success in winning conference championships persuaded lawmakers to fund the current swimming complex, which included one of the first state-of-the-art aquatic research labs in the country. The U.S. Olympic team used it on its way to the Seoul Games. HPR's Lillian Song recently sat down with Coach Prinz. He just published Freestyle Biomechanics. It's a companion to his video series, which uses 35 years of video workshops where elite swimmers were filmed using high-speed cameras.
I think it's important for us to say something about Hawaii swimming, beginning swimming. And I was thinking about this while I was driving here. People are starting to slowly get aware that not just talking about it. Everybody laments the fact that only 50% of kids in Hawaii can swim. Well, now they're doing something about it. One of my graduate students, Dan Warden, is now working out at the Palama Settlement Pool. And the big thing, he has convinced the principals of the schools around, the elementary schools, to schedule a time to send the kids during school to teach to learn swim. And that is a huge step. So if that picks up and then the legislature picks it up, then we're going to get something done. Because summertime, Red Cross, Park and Rec offer free classes, but that was it.
If your family's not aware of these programs, or perhaps if your family's not able to send you to these programs, you might get left behind the crowd.
Absolutely. You get left behind, and then you go with your friends to the beach and get into trouble because you can't swim.
So what I'm hearing from you is really like building swimming into the curriculum for the public schools.
Absolutely. That is the key. So I tell him it's very encouraging.
So Dan Warden is onto something, so he's really a proponent for bringing swimming education back
into... Correct, and he's got a grant from the state to take this and run with it. So I think things are looking up.
We are in summertime. Classes are out. Summer vacation is ongoing. Correct. There's always a beach, a pool here
Absolutely.
In Hawaii.
Plenty of opportunities to swim.
Because I am more of a landlubber. Not much in the water, but that...
That's going to change, right?
After reading... Well, I want to actually acknowledge that, Jen, I think I may have taken one of your classes back at UH.
At UH?
When I had to fulfill a PE credit or something.
Really? Well...
It's ringing a bell for me.
Good. Well, now let's... I hope this is encouraging you to get to a pool.
Well, during the heat, jumping into water definitely is something that appeals, but it's always, as somebody who's a non-swimmer, it's the other parts of swimming that keeps me out of the water.
Yeah,
the water rushing into my nose, how do I get my eyes
open? Well, you need instruction. Lillian, this is a learned skill. It's like golf and tennis. Somebody has to teach you. You can be the most natural swimmer in the world, but somebody has to teach you. And so the parents, they're the ones who have to take the responsibility to make sure the kids find good instruction. But you can't do it by yourself. I mean, they have to teach you how to wear them, put the goggles on properly and how to learn to blow your bubbles through your nose so the water doesn't go up your nose. And, you know, from then on, you can move with it. But this is a learned skill.
Well, the reason why you are here today, Jen, is because you have published Freestyle Biomechanics, The Science Behind the Strokes. It's a paperback companion to a video series that you've already released.
With the same name.
And that came out 2 years ago.
Correct.
Like the title says, really broken down what the freestyle mechanics, biomechanics are.
Correct. See, what usually books do tell you what to do right. All these instructional books, they go through a great deal of detail saying this is the correct way to do it, which is fine. We do that too, but in swimming, even very subtle things you do that don't work, we call them stroke defects, can make a huge difference. So we broke the stroke down into parts, and each of those parts we have examples of things that don't work. And the data we got, Lillian, is from doing 35 years of what we call video workshops, where people came and we filmed them underwater, all the way from world record holders to people off the street who wanted to be better. So we got this massive video database. And so now that's what we put in the book. So somebody going through it, they can spot the defect. Nobody's going to do everything wrong. But there are very specific things that if you change, it can make a world of difference.
Having a coach, having a teacher behind you, watching what, observing what you as a swimmer is doing, they can then point out, your arm needs to be more flat.
Yeah.
Or
there is the priority of things you fix first, second, third, fourth. So the more advanced you get, Lillian, the more subtle the changes are going to have to take place. But at the beginning stages, you got to learn to float on top of the water. You got to learn to kick. You have to learn to breathe. Those are the initial things. But after that, the book itemizes the different things that go wrong in the individual portions of the stroke. And that's what people like.
But Jad, it's also just fascinating too that you were able to, once again, your life is just right place, right time.
Absolutely.
But you know what to ask for. I mean, $5 million to get this facility built up, your lab set in.
Well, the facility, Lillian, had to be completed. They had no locker rooms. This was in 1976. They built the new pool. But they only came up with phase one, which was the chain link fence around the pool and the two pools. Mm. So when I walked in, that's all they had. So for 2 years, we lived open to the elements, no locker rooms. All the people had to change. They built these portable little cabanas. And so we had to have the thing finished, and the legislature knew that. But somebody said, hey, the team better do well before we come up with the money. So I said, okay.
So how well did your team do?
Well, we won the conference championships, and we were ranked in the top 20 in the country.
With your lab that was set up, does this mean we have had Olympic athletes come?
No, absolutely.
Through?
No, I mean, we have pictures. We had Olympic athletes, world record holders coming through. A lot of the people we use as example were from Australia, world record holders. But I'll tell you about the American world record holder, because that's what his name is Anthony Irwin, and he did something that has never been done. He won the 50 freestyle in Sydney Olympics in 2000. And then four Olympics later, he wins the same event. So he wins the event when he was 19, and then at 34, he wins the event again. That's never been done. Michael Phelps swam three Olympics or four Olympics and won quite a bit. But Anthony Irwin, who was one of our subjects, and you see pictures of him, is very unique. He had a four Olympic hiatus and came back and wins the same thing. Michael kept swimming. Mm-hmm. So, he stayed in shape. He competed. But Anthony Irwin didn't swim. Four Olympics later, he does the same thing.
What was the secret sauce there?
Talent and doing what feels good for him. Mm. He's a born sprinter.
So, but he is in the book. He helped you.
Well, he was one of our subjects. And we have, you see there's a lot of world record holders and Olympic champions. We're in a nice place. People want to come here. And so when they come, we grab them.
I feel like your lab is like a hidden treasure.
Well, we've closed the lab now after COVID.
Oh, really?
After 25 years, I decided it's done because the graduate students disappeared and the cost of running the lab was prohibitive during COVID.
Well, this being radio, we do like stories. Any anecdotes you can share with me, with our listeners, about swimming or maybe that aha moment for you as a teacher, somebody who's bringing that beginning swimmer into the water, and what is it like when the light goes on?
Oh, I think once a person can breathe rhythmically, that's when the light goes on, because you can teach people to float on top of the water and kick and use their arms, but their face is still in the water, Lillian. So there's a limited distance you can go on one breath. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they learn how to breathe and they can swim, say, 25 yards, the world has changed. It is like a remarkable. The door has opened and now they're ready to go. And that is the eureka moment.
How long does it take, average?
Oh, good question. Probably, maybe a couple of weeks. If somebody practices regularly, within 3 or 4 weeks, we can have them breathing. But they have to be fairly consistent with their practice. They have to get in the water because the water is a different environment. So you have to get used to it. And goggles have changed things, the way we do things, so people don't have to worry about being blurry and not knowing what's going on. So once they have goggles now for very little kids. So when we had our swimming school, and every swimming school does this, they put goggles on immediately with the kids and have them so it's no problem putting their face in the water. That was the biggest hurdle, we were trying to get the kid to put their face in the water. But now with the goggles on, they put their face in, they can see everything. So life is very different.
Back in the day when you started swimming, Jan, did you have goggles?
Oh, we did ocean swims, Lillian. There was a race that we swam 2 miles in the ocean. Our eyes were shut. You can imagine, by the end of the race, we couldn't see. So, no, there were no goggles until about the mid-70s. There were no goggles. I would say even a little bit earlier, but if you watch the Olympics in like 1968, there was no goggles. So it changed dramatically.
Well, it's a life skill that everybody can benefit from.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is not fun and games. This is a serious business. You know, you can say, oh, we live in the island. But as you said, you can either run away or come and swim. But this is one of the most pleasurable things. It's a life skill that you can use all the rest of your life. And as we get older, we need to take the weight off our hips, knees. I have lots of people I know constantly telling me they have hip replacements, knee replacements. And how do you stay in shape after that? You get in the water because you can't just stop doing things. And so swimming is a very, very, this is not an adjunct. It's an essential skill that you need to be able to do. So the dean also, we all agree that 25 years is a good run. And now the lab is being turned over and they're going to start a Doctor of Physical Therapy program. And there's an athletic training program now in our department, has been there for a while. So the department of kinesiology is going to use the facility for the DPT program and continue with the athletic training program. Okay. It's a lovely facility.
You yourself, just looking back on your career, what are some takeaways? What could you, some final words of wisdom to leave with our listeners?
Do what you like. I'm going on my 49th year. People, I want to know when I'm going to retire, and I have no plans. I always say jokingly, Thomas Edison, when he was asked the question, he said, the day before my funeral. So that's my retort. But no, seriously, I enjoy what I'm doing, Lillian. I love what I'm doing. Why would I want to walk away? You know, it doesn't make any sense to walk away something like that. Plus, I live in Hawaii. And that's what got started. I mean, I've been very fortunate. You know, I've been in the right place at the right time all the way through. I'm very fortunate.
That was UH head swimming coach Jan Prinz and HPR's Lillian Song. And full disclosure, I too was one of Coach Prinz's students. I got help on my swim stroke. Prinz recently published Freestyle Biomechanics, the Science Behind the Strokes, as a companion to the video series that aims to help improve your swim stroke. Prinz says a podcast is in the works. We will share links to the book and online video program on our website later today. Well, we're out of time, so we have to go. But tomorrow, we have a call-in show planned. Public school students head back to the classroom on Monday, the first day of a cell phone ban. We will break it down. Got some feedback for us? Got questions about the ban? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.